Good morning, everyone. I am opening today's Revenue Committee meeting and welcoming our invited guests, members of the Transportation Committee, Transportation Economic Development. They aren't all here yet, but we welcome them anyway because our day today is a sort of a joint discussion on several transportation and funding issues that sort of cross the committee lines. So that is why it is joint. Mazen is going to open today with an overview of transportation funding and a few gentle passes at House Bill 2001 from last session and how they intersect with the Revenue Committee. Mazen, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Berger and members of both committees. I think Representative Benz is a member of both committees, so he gets a very special say today. Transportation. I've put in your packet. You have a packet of about five pages, and then a few other stuff. And I would be referring to those as we go. I'm going to give a very high level, quick idea of how does Oregon fund transportation and why we think it is a little bit different. You know, the transportation finance and transportation funding is one of these things that has a very special way of looking at it. It's a government, a public good type of delivery, if you will, delivered by government, but it's so unique and different. It is not in the same way that you would look at the social safety net, for example. Or it's not the same thing as you would look at other government services. And it's also different than what you would look at major infrastructure projects, not like water systems or other types of systems. So it has this strange hybrid type of treatment, if you will. It has both the government delivery, and at the same time, it has this allowance for private operators to do it either for profit or for their own good. So in that sense, we have the different way of looking at funding and why we have a highway fund and a different system of delivery for these and other constitutional requirements. These things that we would go very quickly over, what happened in the quick history that you have in your packet, and then going all the way to House Bill 2001 of the 2009 session, the Jobs and Transportation Act. A lot of people refer to it as JTA, but I'm not going to do that today. So the main idea is how roads should be financed, and we talk about equity, and equity is very special in this way. It goes with the same idea that we were talking about of where the who pays and why, and who gets the benefit of that payment. Economic neutrality, the main thing that we don't want to create nor winners or losers in this transportation system. Cost efficiency. And then we go to the very special, having remember the transportation is a very special, strange hybrid. It fits very well with the, you know, Oregon type of looking at things. so we have, and that probably will explain all the special hybrid ways that you would find in transportation professionals, by the way. So how we should pay for those roads, and then what is the brief history is in your packet. You have a constitutional dedication, and there is legal definition, other uses of the term. And these are important things for reasons that probably will come apparent soon. Now, everybody talks about the highway fund as a constitutional piece of information. Everybody refers to it always and all the time as a matter of fact. Now, this is what the constitutional dedication says. It says you have revenue that needs to be used for repair and maintenance and so on. And then it defines where that comes from. So it's on fuel used for propelling motor vehicle or ownership and operation of the motor vehicles. And you have some uses for administration, refunds, and so on. And then it talks about different pieces to be used. Now, if you take a look at this, there is no mention of the highway fund in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't really tell you there is a highway fund. There is just dedication for these revenues, dedication for the certain uses of those revenues. So, in other words, that's what the Constitution says. It says fuels tax and puts the pieces of the puzzle, the 8-mile tax, and puts the flat fees, road use assessment, and then goes with vehicle registration for both light and heavy. And you have title fees. These are the ownership piece in the Constitution. And finally, it talks about operation, which is drivers. So driver license. This is how the puzzle looks like with the constitutional definition.
Nice piece.
Now, you have in the statutes a legal definition of what the highway fund is. And that basically defines what the Oregon road use of taxation is. And that's in 366.505. And it tells you that the highway fund, this is the only place where the highway fund is explicitly spelled out. Highway fund is consists of, and talks about bonds, licensing, and all these different sources, interest, federal money, and so on. The picture looks a little different between the constitutional definitions and the legal definitions. So you have those bonds, the interest, the Fed, that was not part of your constitutional definition. Yet, there is a third way of looking at this. Remember, when we always talk about the highway fund, we talk about it as state and locals, state, county, and city. And those have a definition within also the statutes of what goes where by how much. And, of course, that changed with time. And not everything that is in the highway fund gets sliced that way, at least not in the statutes. So you have only these few pieces of the puzzle that do. Now, that also, the distribution have changed with time. In the beginning, this is where the base says it was, and then OTIA came, gave different distribution. The bridge program, or what's so-called OTIA 3, gave a third one. The miscellaneous is the time when there was a 60-40 split for counties and cities out of very few ones, like plate fees and exams or tests for the driver licenses. House Bill 2001 gave a new definition of the split about 50-30-20. So a little different definitions when people talk about the highway fund, and just to keep it in mind when they talk about it, not everybody means the same thing. So you have your vehicle registration fee. This is how we look at the highway funding. We look at it in both as fixed cost or fixed funding versus variable funding. The fixed would be your vehicle registration fees. After House Bill 2001, it's $86 a biennium. It continues to be very low compared to other states. And then your heavy went from 169, 636 at the top, to 344 and 1295 at the top. This is registration by weight, 2,000-pound increment weights. So House Bill 2001 bumped up the registration quite a bit.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have a question. May I ask?
Please.
Thank you. Madison, can you go back to that? Yes. Is there is that number, that $30 and that $50 fixed in relation to what's charged for the heavier vehicles, or it's fixed in relation to the damage they do, or what's the link between that number and whatever we use to establish it?
President Benz, the light vehicles are charged on a fixed, like used to be $30.86 now. Remember, a lot of the light vehicle cost responsibility, and we will get into the cost responsibility section soon. A lot of their variable cost is primarily comes from fuel tax, how much they pay in the fuel. Now, they also are numerous in their registration, so they represent a big payment at one time in the registration of the title fees. The tools, if you will, for the heavy are not as many. You have only registration and you have only weight mile. The titles are not much. You're not necessarily titling, you don't have an advantage of titling in Oregon versus not. You could title anywhere. So the tools are primarily two: heavy registration and weight mile tax. And because they're both are weight dependent, you try to adjust with the cost responsibility of the different classes of vehicles, different weights by both registration on one side, which is sometimes for different purposes, different uses, is easier to take by the heavy vehicles in the trucking industry. They find it easier because it's known commodity, it's one time, and then it's at the beginning.
Follow up.
Yes.
The initial point of reference is weight.
Right.
And then you go to the effort to equalize.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. But if you recall, Representative, those numbers, the 30, the 54, and the 86, were statutory by the legislature. And then everything flows from there to equalize.
Actually, I do understand.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I do recall.
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, we start with the light and then adjust the heavy. But the heavy also makes it to the statutes. But we try to allow for that adjustment. And that's what we do, and that's what we did in House Bill 2001. It took us a while to do this.
Did your question get answered?
It did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Title fees. Also, and as you notice, the $90 on the heavy stays the same. What House Bill 2001 did is 77 increased to $77 on the light, $27 on the salvage and duplicate vehicles. The variable part, as we were talking in the fuel stacks, it used to be 24 cents, just turned into 30 cents on 1-1-11. There are different fuel stacks for also different types of fuel, and you have some of the fuel tax funding other types like the ATVs, aviation, the snowmobile, and then always like to talk about the lawnmower fund or the operating fund. The weight mile tax, you have table A and which is from 26,000 to 80,000 pounds. Those are the, after 2001, these are the beginning payment levels. So you are at 4.98 cents per mile for the 26,000 and 16.38 cents per mile for 80,000. Then you have Table B. Table B allows for more axles to be put on the vehicle, so it distributes the weights and has less damage on the road. And then you have your in-lieu, which is the flat fees, which you later also will get the report that is required by the statutes about the flat fee and the requirements. Road use assessment fees. So if you look at the weight mile with a question of why is weight mile for heavy vehicle versus the fuel for the light, the primary issue is although fuel consumption in the heavy vehicles goes heavier with heavy weights, it does not capture as much of the cost responsibility as it should. So the difference between the 80,000-pound, 50,000-pound trucks is almost double with the weight component of the cost responsibility, but the consumption goes only about 15 to 20%. So that's where the assumption needs to go with the weight mile. So if you put the weight mile tax tables for table A and B after House Bill 2001, this is how these tables look like, and the different colors refer to the different number of axles. And as you see, table B starts at the 80,000 pounds and above. So once you get to the 80,000 pounds, the more you put axles on your truck, the better the treatment and the less tax that you have to pay, which gives you an incentive to have less damage on the road. So the in lieu taxes, the flat fees, you would get a report on them later on, but this is how they look after 2001. What you would see in the report is not the House Bill 2001. It would be before the House Bill 2001. The road use assessment fees, these are for the heaviest of the heavy, if you will. And ESILs is equivalent single axle load per mile. Finally, the Oregon Constitution connects the tools that we talked about with what's so-called the system, which is the state-imposed user fee. Those are that vehicle classes pay in proportion to costs incurred on their behalf, which leads us to the Constitution segment or the piece in Article 9, Section 3A, that talks about the cost responsibility, if you will. This is to ensure adjustments and fairness between the different classes of vehicles. And in order to put it in statute, this is the statute that allows or requires the state economist and DAS to do the highway cost allocation, which you will be receiving now. And of course, it shows that you're, as a, both committees, transportation and revenue, on both sides of the chambers are the ones who deal with these issues and change and adjust rates if rates needs to be adjusted. The House Bill 2001, Jobs and Transportation Acts, a lot of it was implemented in January 1st, 2001. This is the full implementation. When it fully implemented, it would have been January 1st, 2011. The main idea of it, that it will have $300 million per year. The money will be distributed about $3 million for the Travel Information Council. These are for rest areas, $24 million for the ODOT long-range plan, which goes in a way to allow for the federal funds to be used otherwise. And then the balance of the money, about $273 million per year, would go 20% to cities, that's about 55 million, 30% to counties, about 82 million, and 50% to the state, 136.5. And there is also a prescription for how the state spends the money. And 33% maintenance preservation, and you see the percentages here. A lot more details of House Bill 2001 is in your packet. I put almost all the stuff that you ever want to know about House Bill 2001, and also the estimates of where the revenue comes from, how it goes, and for how many new years of forecast, and of course it included our 2009 revenue impact statement at that time. And finally, also, we require in law that ODOT report quarterly on the amount of revenue that they get from 2001. You also will find it in your packet. That's the details that you would have. And I'll be remiss if you don't mention the other revenue modes that we fund also through law, and that would give you the background to receive your highway cost allocation.
Any further questions of Mazin? Representative Wan?
I do. Thank you. Sorry for being late this morning, but I walked in right at the right time talking about HB 2001. And I'm wondering, when that bill was being discussed, specifically with regard to the county vehicle registration fees, was there testimony or did anyone talk about the fact that that's a regressive tax that hurts, that hits people even when they're unemployed and even when they don't have sufficient ability to pay? Was that a consideration that was discussed during committee when that bill was passed?
Representative Juan, Mazin was not staffing to the Transportation Committee at the time that 2001, so you're asking really the wrong person.
Okay.
But we'd be happy to discuss that whole issue with you at a later time. We have another agenda this morning.
Okay. Thank you.
But, Representative Wall, just to go in general, we do differentiate between the different types of taxation for transportation. And it was a policy choice. That. So.
Thank you, Mazin.
Here, I'll give it to the highway cost allocation people, and I'll.
Without further questions, as Mazin has outlined, it is our responsibility to hear the cost allocation study, and we'd like to ask Tom Potowski, our state economist, and his Echo Northwest team to come forward and give us this report.
Thank you. I'm going to have, good morning, Madam Chair. Representative Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee, and guests from the Transportation Economic Development Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And before bringing up the consultants, I'm having with me two members of a study review team that we have that helps us review basically the consultants' work and is in an advisory capacity. And to my left is Tim Morgan with the AAA Auto Club of Oregon, Idaho. And to my right is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association. It's rare that you find these two people sitting at the same table, but I have strategically placed myself between them. But I just want to so that you can see some faces and that the process that we have really does take almost a good year and a half. To do this study. We usually start in July, August of an odd year. We put out requests for proposals for consultants to undertake the study. They are awarded generally in November or December. Then either at the end of December or early January, we have about 8 to 9 meetings with a study review team that acts in an advisory capacity. The consultants always have the last word. But I didn't know if either Bob Russell or Tim Morgan wanted to say something about the process.
Right. Welcome their comments, as long as you're between them, Tom.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chairman, so many chairs these days. We're really pleased with the work that's being done by the Office of Economic Analysis on the cost allocation study. The good news is that you will hear that the study is balanced, cars and trucks, without you taking any action. Sort of the exciting thing is one of the pieces that we put in House Bill 2001 was that we were looking at a different method of cost allocation called the efficient fee method, and you'll be hearing more about that this morning. That's the future of cost allocation, and from our perspective, it's really exciting. There's some things we need to do, but we need to continue to pursue that method of cost allocation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I just that was just for their comments. Thank you, and then we'll have the consultants come up.
Thank you.
Thanks. Do you want me to change chairs?
Welcome. We ask that you state your name before you begin.
Thank you, Chair People, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carl Batten. I'm with Echo Northwest in Portland. We were the consultants selected to do the highway cost allocation study this time. This is the 17th highway cost allocation study in Oregon so far. The first was in 1937, and since 1999, the state constitution has required a study every 2 years. And if the study finds that that the revenues are not fair and proportionate to the costs imposed, the legislature is required to adjust the revenues. So the question that the Constitution asks is, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? Tom already told you about the study review team. There's a list of all of the members of that team. So in order to answer the question that's posed by the Constitution, we do a highway cost allocation study. Oregon's not the only state that does these. Several other states do them. No other state does them as often or as well as Oregon. And in 1997, the federal government did a nationwide highway cost allocation study as well. So the process for doing a highway cost allocation study is first to define user classes. And in Oregon, the definition of user classes is based on weight. We have basic vehicles that weigh less than 10,000 pounds. We have medium vehicles, which for constitutional purposes are considered heavy rather than light. Those are between 10,000 and 26,000 pounds. And then we have heavy vehicles, which go in 2,000-pound increments. And as Mazin pointed out, the vehicles between 26,000 and 80,000 pounds pay on Schedule A of the weight mile tax. Those between 80,000 and 105,500 pounds pay on Schedule B, which also takes into account the number of axles. And those over, certain vehicles over 96,000, but all vehicles over 105,500 pounds pay the road use assessment fee, which is a more complicated derivation based on weight of each axle. And those vehicles also require a permit for every trip. They have to justify that the weight is required because the load is non-divisible and they have to get the route approved. So then we allocate costs to the different user classes. We attribute the revenues that each user class pays, and then we calculate an equity ratio. And in the numerator of the equity ratio is their share of revenues, and the denominator is their share of costs. And if the equity ratio is 1, then they're paying their fair share. If it's higher than 1, they're paying more than their fair share. And if it's lower than 1, they're paying less than their fair share. For the 2011 study, we took two different approaches at the direction of the 2009 legislature. In the traditional approach, budgeted expenditures are assumed to be the costs, and those expenditures are allocated out to vehicle classes. In the efficient fee approach, we try to estimate the actual costs imposed, which may add up to a number that's different than budgeted expenditures. And the way we do that is we assume that each vehicle would pay a set of fees that represent the cost that vehicle is imposing at the time and place that it is traveling. And then we add up the imaginary revenues that would be collected from those imaginary fees and use that as the measure of cost. In both approaches, the revenue attribution is the same, and it's based on current law instruments and rate structures. So under the traditional approach, the costs to allocate are the expenditures budgeted for the upcoming biennium. We include the expenditures of federal funds because those are almost perfectly fungible with the expenditure of state funds. We also include expenditures by local governments of state funds. And as Mazin showed you, a large portion of the money collected for the state highway fund is distributed out to the counties and cities. And we count the expenditure of that money by the counties and cities. We also include some expenditures by local governments of their own source funds as well as their expenditure of federal funds. The own source funds we don't include are those that are dedicated to particular purposes and are not interchangeable with state funds. And in Chapter 2 of the report you have, you can see the full details of how we do it. Under the efficient fee approach, we define some imaginary fees that vehicles would pay if they were to be charged directly for the cost they impose. There are wear and tear charges that are based on the weight of the vehicle, its configuration, primarily the number of axles, and on the characteristics of the roads and bridges that they use. There's also a congestion charge based on the amount of cost that that vehicle imposes on other vehicles, given the time and place that it's traveling. And there are emissions charges based on the amount of emissions that the vehicle produces as it travels. We did both approaches this time and got very nearly the same answer under each approach. The traditional approach showed that light vehicles were paying 99.5% of their fair share, and heavy vehicles were paying 100.9% of their fair share, which is well within the margin of error for calling it one. The efficient fee approach showed almost the same thing. It showed that light vehicles were paying just a little bit less than the traditional approach as a proportion of their fair share. The I'll point out that the total dollar amounts, the shares came out the same, but the total dollar amount under the efficient fee approach was a little bit higher, indicating that according to the assumptions we used in the efficient fee study, the optimal amount to spend on highways in Oregon is a little bit more than what is budgeted for the upcoming biennium. For some detail on the heavy vehicles, we said that the heavy vehicles altogether as a group are paying very nearly their fair share. When you look at individual weight classes, some are paying more and some are paying less. The medium vehicles between 10,000 and 26,000 pounds are overpaying. Most vehicles in the Schedule A are underpaying. However, the 78 to 80,000 pound vehicles, which is 44% of all heavy vehicles, are overpaying. And most vehicles over 80,000 pounds are underpaying, as are the road use assessment fee vehicles. And in Chapter 6 of the report you have, it shows the details for every weight class. The recommendations of the study, no changes to rates are necessary under the constitutional requirement. You're very close to a 1.0 equity ratio. We do offer some revenue neutral changes to the rate structures that would improve equity within heavy vehicles, and those are entirely optional. The Table A rate structures, the lowest rates could be increased and the highest rates could be decreased a little bit, which would increase equity. And the Table B, almost all of the rates would go up some, and the road use assessment fee would basically double. The efficient fee study, which is new for 2011, as I said, each vehicle would pay an imaginary fee for each mile that it travels. The fee would have five components. There would be a congestion charge, which is based on the cost of delay that that vehicle imposes on others by being on the road at that place and that time. There would be a wear and tear charge, for damages that that vehicle does to the roads. There would be a wear and tear charge for bridges. There would be an emissions charge. And then there would be a charge for administrative and other costs. we estimate the share of efficient fee charges that would be paid by each vehicle class and call that their share of costs. And then we compare that to the share of revenue under current law instruments and rates to determine how close the current law rates come to delivering equity as measured under the efficient fee theory of cost. The congestion charge varies with the volume and capacity of each road segment. We assume that the price would change continuously. There are actual implementations in hot lane settings in California where the price changes every 3 minutes. So it is technically feasible to do that. Since the fee won't actually be charged, we use current volumes to determine share of cost, because in the upcoming biennium, the fee won't be charged, and people will continue to travel at the places and times they would be expected to. If the fee were in place, we would expect some significant changes in the amount of congestion that would be observed. And if the fee were in place, the amount of revenue that would be collected from the fee would be about half the amount that would be collected in the imaginary fee where people don't change their behavior. Because of the nature of the volume delay relationship on roads, small changes in the once a road becomes congested, small changes in the number of vehicles can cause big changes in the amount of delay that those vehicles that all the vehicles on the road experience. So if a small proportion of the vehicles can be encouraged through a fee to take another route or travel at a different time, the amount of delay suffered by all travelers goes down by quite a bit. So we scale the congestion fee revenues down to add up to what they would if the fee were actually in place, because we believe that represents the amount of optimal investment in relieving congestion. The scaled-down congestion charges amount to close to $210 million of annual revenue, or 13% of the total. And light vehicles would pay 96% of those, because during the most congested times, the light vehicles take up a larger proportion of the traffic that's on the road at those times and places. The heavier vehicles try to avoid the most congested times and places, even without a congestion charge in place. The wear and tear charges are determined by the cost of preservation and maintenance that they impose on the system. They vary with the weight and configuration of the vehicle, as well as the strength and condition of the roads and bridges. If a road has been under-maintained historically, the wear and tear charge will be higher until the road is brought up to standard. If it's overbuilt, the wear and tear charge will be lower than the average cost until the level of traffic comes up to what the road was built for. Wear and tear charges. Excuse me?
And where is that overbuilt highway in Oregon?
I don't know.
That was a rhetorical question. Go on.
Sometimes very large facilities are deliberately overbuilt when they're first constructed, expecting increases in traffic over time.
I understand.
The wear and tear charges would generate $453 million for roads and $163 million for bridges. And that's almost 40% of the total revenue under the efficient fee system. Light vehicles would pay 37% of that. The emissions charges are determined by the cost that emissions impose on everyone. And While for the purposes of this study, we calculated them as if they were charged per mile for the different vehicle classes, the best way to implement an emissions fee is to charge it per unit of fuel, because the relationship is very close to the amount of fuel that's consumed. Emissions charges would generate $493 million of revenue, which is 32% of the total, and light vehicles would pay 67% of the emissions charges. If emissions charges were imposed, they could be spent to offset administrative and other costs associated with highways. But the $493 million would be insufficient to completely offset those costs, so you would need to raise an additional $239 million. And the way we've modeled that is as a flat per mile charge, and light vehicles would pay 93% of a flat per mile charge because they account for 93% of the vehicle miles traveled. One of the things that House Bill 2001 asked the efficient fee study to do was to make recommendations for getting toward an efficient fee system. The main way to get there is by charging vehicles for the costs they impose at the times and places they travel. The highway users would then adjust their behavior to best meet their own needs given the costs they impose on everyone. And as an additional benefit, when each vehicle is paying the costs it imposes, there would be no more need for highway cost allocation studies. The second key to getting to an efficient system is optimal investment in capacity preservation and maintenance. Highway agencies would adjust their behavior to best meet the needs of highway users. And just as a note, where it's cost effective, capacity may be provided by investing in alternative modes. That is a little bit difficult under the current constitutional constraints, but under economic theory, it would be an appropriate use of congestion fee revenues if the most efficient way to relieve congestion is to invest in other modes to get vehicles off the road. The first step toward all of this is better data, both for least cost planning and for looking at alternative revenue sources. We need many more functioning traffic counters in Oregon, and we need better information about the nature and condition of our roads and bridges. That's the presentation. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Benton. Questions from, I thought you might have a question. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for the excellent presentation. Although it's great to see my former colleagues here before the committee, the level of analysis and sophistication is far greater than anything I ever dealt with. And so I have a few quick questions, if it's okay, Madam Co-Chair.
Certainly.
I'm struck by the similarity between the two methods of analysis and how close the results are. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about why that's the case. I would assume that in the efficient fee method, since you are calculating congestion, theoretical congestion pricing and the cost of emissions into that study, that somehow that might then show greater costs to the system than simply looking at expenditures in an instance in which we do not actually budget for directly for congestion or for emissions. How do those two things relate so closely?
It's purely random chance that it came out that close. The wear and tear charges hit trucks much more heavily than the current fee structure. the congestion charges hit cars much more heavily than the current fee structure. And the combination of the congestion charge and the common cost charge to make up the rest of the administrative and other costs comes out to something fairly close to the current proportions. And taken together, they just happen to add up to the same proportion that the current law rates come to. And if the administrative and other charges were lower, it would be the balance would be a lot more fragile.
So help me understand, does that imply that because the expenditure method does not take into account true congestion costs or emissions costs, that although the proportions work out in the share between light vehicles, heavy vehicles, might there be some inefficiency in how those costs and revenues are allocated under the current system?
Yes. The fact that the shares of average costs come out to the same as the shares of what economists call marginal costs is nice for equity purposes, but charging people the average cost doesn't give them the incentive to behave optimally. So if people faced a higher cost by traveling on especially congested roads, then that would encourage them to change their behavior, where there's no incentive like that now. Someone traveling on a nearly empty road in eastern Oregon pays the same gas tax as someone traveling on Highway 217 at rush hour right now. So there's no none of the incentives that efficient fees would provide for more optimal behavior. The same thing with the emissions. If people actually paid significantly more for making more emissions, they would have an incentive to make fewer emissions, where now they pay the average. And the gas tax actually serves as a fairly efficient emissions charge, even though it isn't intended to be that. And it isn't, the level of the gas tax isn't set to match the cost of emissions.
Further question?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to draw out a couple points that I believe that you made and make sure that we're clear on them. So we might be able to make the transportation system more efficient in terms of costs, in terms of budgeting, in terms of revenue, if we were to shift to methods where we included such things as pricing congestion and drawing revenue from congestion, as well as pricing emissions, whether that's through the proxy of a gas tax or perhaps more directly through direct emissions fees. Is that correct?
Yes.
Final follow-up, Co-Chair. Yes. And I want to draw one final point that I believe I heard you make during your testimony, in that if we were to move towards that more efficient system, I think I heard you say that it would be more efficient than to use that revenue from congestion pricing and from emissions pricing in order to mitigate congestion and mitigate emissions, regardless of whether or not that mitigation occurred through investments in transportation infrastructure or through shifting to other forms of transportation projects, such as multimodal transportation and getting people off the road. Is that also correct?
The charges themselves, if they're set to reflect the marginal costs at the time, send the right signals to, they set the incentives at the right levels for people to behave in the optimal way. once the money has been collected, it's then a different question, what's the optimal way to spend that money? And an economist would recommend that the money be spent in the way that produces the most benefit to society. And so whether that's on mitigating emissions damages or on increasing capacity or maintain or improving the condition of roads, that's a question that can be addressed through least cost planning and applying benefit cost analysis.
Comment, Madam?
Please.
Thank you. While our good representative Beyer has left, I want to commend her and the members of this committee that worked on House Bill 2001 last session for including in that bill a congestion pricing pilot program, a new definition of least cost planning, and I think other items that will hopefully guide this state towards a much better and more efficient transportation system.
Thank you. Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Ms. Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So when you're conducting the economic analysis into congestion pricing, wouldn't you, in order to obtain an accurate result, have to include the lost time and additional commute times that are incurred in multimodal transportation? And wouldn't that have to factor into the incentive or disincentive on the part of an individual person deciding whether to get into their car with the congestion pricing or whether to jump onto the light rail without the congestion pricing but with significantly added commute times?
Yes, and we didn't have sufficient data on each trip in Oregon to be able to do that, so the way we took that into account was we used the results of a pilot study that we conducted in the Seattle area to estimate what proportion of what the elasticity is, which is the proportional change in the amount of travel on the road to the proportional change in price. And in the Seattle study, we found that the average was a 4% decrease in travel for a 100% increase in price. Another finding from that study was that when in zones in the Seattle area that had good transit service, the responsiveness was 14%, more than three times as high. So those who had reasonable transit alternatives were more likely to reduce their travel than those who did not, and that reflects the difference in travel times and costs.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This may be a question for Mazlin, but in looking at the Constitution, it states that we're supposed to be recovering the costs of maintenance, operation, and improvement. Is the thought that the cost congestion charge based on cost of delay imposed on others, does it fit what operation? Where does it fit in our Constitution that we could charge for that? And I just ask because it's so interesting to see the approach the state has used in looking forward at that, what we plan to spend and then allocating that. That seems to be quite different from the efficient device. And so I want to start with the Constitution and just go there first with whoever is equipped to answer that question. Mazin?
I'm certainly not equipped to answer the constitutional question, so Mazin, but I do have a follow-up to what Mazin will say.
Well, I, Representative Benz, with that anticipation in mind, I think that the traditional method is supposedly the method that follows the constitutional construct. So we're doing the traditional method as the Constitution requires us to do. The efficient fee was introduced in House Bill 2001, thinking that this would be the future kind of way of doing it. We're not making any decisions nor thinking that this would be the complete alternative yet. However, once we start going to that conclusion, there probably needs to be some, I'm not going to say soul searching, constitutional searching, if you will.
Does that answer?
Yes.
Did you have a follow-up on that?
Yes. What I wanted to say was that the correspondence between the different portions of the efficient fee, the wear and tear charges would correspond to the maintenance and preservation expenditures, and the congestion charges would correspond to the, what the highway people call modernization or increase in capacity. So investments in adding lanes to roads, which isn't maintenance, but it is covered under the highway fund. That's the kind of thing that would correspond to the congestion charge.
Yes.
Thank you. And the emissions charge?
And the emissions charge has no place in the current transportation funding.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three short things I'd like to toss out, and if there's a response, fine. If there's not, then it's just comments about how this all works. And if I missed it earlier, I'm sorry. I was in another hearing room for a while. One thing that interests me is thinking about how a change in a statewide approach to a fee could interplay or not with local choices or local options to layer on an additional fee for some additional local projects. And I'm not sure the extent to which that further complicates studying behaviors, you know, choices about whether you're going to drive or not, what's going on in that local area versus a statewide decision. The second of three things is in thinking about how to determine maintenance costs and how that factors into wear and tear calculations and so forth. In some places, maintenance is really, let's say the maintenance of certain roads is a more routine kind of maintenance, and it's at one level. But in other places where roads have been neglected for too long, maintenance involves a lot more. You might be digging up a lot more down to the roadbed and replacing a lot more rather than just adding on the surface sealant and so forth. And so there are going to be variations from one local area or one region to another, how much it costs for this so-called maintenance charge and whether they've been keeping up with maintenance or basically neglecting it for lack of money. And then the third thing is in thinking about travel time, how to calculate whether people are going to choose to shift to some other mode. I guess some of what I've read leads me to think it's we need to understand more about the travel experience. It's not only literally the trip time in the car versus the bus, but the time to park. You know, if you had your car, where are you going to park? Do you pay for parking? And is the parking garage three blocks from where you work or where you go to school? How does that compare to, well, gee, I found a bus or a light rail, and now I'm within a half a block, or amenities that are along the way? You know, you can get your latte if it's right there at the transit stop. But if you're in a car, you go through a drive-thru and you sit with the car idling behind five other cars getting fancy lattes. So it's that trip thing, too. It's not just the travel time, but some other things that get added on to it. So the more I think about this, I can look at some calculations, but then I always wonder what else should have been in that calculations.
I'm going to let the panel respond briefly to your comments, but I'm going to preamble it a little bit. This is a statewide study that is required, and it looks at these things in a very global sense. And I love your page 15, your last thing that says, first step is better data. Because I think you're absolutely right. We are looking at the data that we have, and I applaud this study going into the data in a different way than we have traditionally done it. And it's amazing that it affirms the traditional data in some sense as not being that far off if you dig down deeper using a different way of measuring and looking at it. But I think the questions that you raise are the same ones that we grapple with every time we start talking about driving, its costs, and what happens. This study won't answer those questions, but I if you have thoughts on the ideas she's putting forward, I'd certainly welcome them.
I have thoughts on two of those. On the last one regarding people's choice of travel mode, like I said, one of the things we found in the Seattle study was that given the current alternatives that are available to people, the primary response to pricing for people who did change their behavior was to travel at a different time. Mm-hmm. They still drove to where they were driving, but they drove at a different time. They went a little earlier or a little later than they otherwise would have. The second most common response was to take a different route. And the third was to choose a different mode of transportation. Now that presumably could change if the menu available to those people changed and had more attractive options other than driving to the same place at approximately the same time. On the second question, could you remind
me? One of them was about maintenance.
Yes. All right. Thank you. The imaginary system that we used for the wear and tear charge would imagine that the maintenance charge would, or the wear and tear charge would vary with the road you were on. So if a road were thin pavement and a heavy truck wanted to use that road, they would pay a much higher charge on that road than they would on, for example, a freeway that has a thick layer of concrete and was built to support heavy trucks. The charges also would be higher on under-maintained roads until sufficient money were raised and spent to bring them up to standard, and then the maintenance charge would go down over time.
Interesting. Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I hesitate to ask this question, but I'm forced to do so by a bill that's pending concerning snow tires. And I'm wondering if the refinement of our methodology is just to weight, and then we don't look behind that weight. In other words, we don't look at heavy trucks that have chains. We don't look at cars that have studded snow tires. We don't look at congestion. Can you tell me if I am viewing this methodology correctly, or do we have some refinements in the law which I'm not aware of?
I'm not aware of any refinements in the law, but in the traditional highway cost allocation study, we look at the expenditures on repairing studded tire damage. We estimate those expenditures, and we allocate those costs to light vehicles because only light vehicles have studded tires. We don't address the issue of chains on either light or heavy vehicles at all. And part of the reason for that is that in most cases, the chains are in use only when the vehicle is traveling on snow or ice, and the road is somewhat protected by the snow and ice from damage. There undoubtedly is some damage, and people don't always get their chains off as soon as they're on dry pavement, but the large dollar costs associated with winter tires are people with studded tires driving on snow-free pavement for months on end.
Follow up.
Yes.
You left the congestion out. Can you address that too? Are we currently, except for the time people spend parked with their cars running in a traffic jam, are we collecting from them for that congestion?
No.
Further questions from this group? Thank you very much.
If I may, Madam Chair, sorry.
Yeah.
No, I'm done.
No.
That's it.
No, if you've got something to add, please.
All I wanted to add was a public statement to ODOT and the Finance and Economic Analysis Unit, in particular John Maris, who's just been an institution there and has been so instrumental in raising the quality of this study over the years. He's threatening to retire. And it'll be a huge loss for us. But I just wanted to mention that special thanks to him.
Thank you for that. Is he in the room? Presumably he's watching somewhere. And we do appreciate his efforts. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you for this really interesting study and the way that it was changed to look at things a different way.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to do it.
Thank you. Members, as part, as Mazin indicated, as part of our requirement, we need to look at a review of the flat fee rates, and Greg Del Ponte from ODOT is here, and anyone he would like to bring with him, another into-the-weeds study of transportation, and Greg, welcome.
Madam Co-Chair, members and guests of the House Revenue Committee, good morning. I'm Greg Del Ponte. I'm ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division Administrator. You have my formal testimony coming around. I'll summarize it for you this morning. You've heard this morning that commercial motor carriers operating trucks over 26,000 pounds pay a weight mile tax that's predicated on the miles driven and the declared weight of the vehicle combination. Motor carriers that are reporting and paying weight mile tax have to maintain careful records every time they change the configuration of their vehicle and when they're running off of public highways and when they are operating in and outside of the state of Oregon. The Oregon flat fee payment option originated in 1949 as a way to make road use tax reporting easier for log haulers initially. Who regularly operate off of the public use highways. I once heard it described in this way by a lobbyist for the Forest Products Transportation Association. In many instances, the typical log hauler in Oregon in 1949 was a single truck operation owned and operated by a husband and wife. The husband drove the truck during the day, maintained the truck at home in the evenings, and his wife generally was the bookkeeper, taking care of the record keeping at the kitchen table after the dinner dishes were cleared away. The notion here was to ease the record keeping burden on those carriers. And after that flat fee option was made available to log haulers originally in 1949, it was offered to sand and gravel haulers in 1969 and to woodchip haulers in 1983. The flat fee option is also made available to farm trucks operating at 46,000 pounds or less, operating for hire, but there's not a single farmer in the state that takes advantage of it. So with that said, Oregon law requires that the Department of Transportation in every even-numbered year undertakes a study to determine if the flat fee or the average monthly fee for the equivalent weight mile tax paid by haulers of flat fee eligible commodities is roughly equal as a class of taxpayers, not by individual taxpayer, but as a class of taxpayer, to what would have been paid had all the tax been reported and paid on a weight mile tax basis, on a mileage basis. To fulfill that requirement, the department hires Dr. Catherine Lawson from the University at Albany in New York to conduct a revenue neutrality study of the flat fee rates. Most recently, her report dated September 2010 was completed. It's attached to my testimony, and it uses 2009 data to come to the determination that not shouldn't come as a surprise. Some flat fee payers paid a little more. Some flat fee payers paid a little less than they should have had they been reporting and paying on a strictly mileage basis. But the point I would draw to your attention is that a flat fee is, after all, an approximation. It's all about estimation. So it's unlikely that we'll ever see the day that there is absolute one-to-one parity between what is paid by a flat fee and what should have been paid or could have been paid on a straight mileage basis. And so in that regard, as opposed to constantly revising the rates every single time the Legislative Assembly comes together, what has been the practice is that the study results are observed over time and we react to the trend. And so on that basis, if you look at the last two reports, comparing the reports that were based on 2007 data and 2009 data, my testimony summarizes that the discrepancy is narrowing. We are getting closer rather than farther apart with the rates. That's one factor to take into consideration. A second factor is that, as has been discussed, the Jobs and Transportation Act did increase the flat fee rates last legislative session. That's another variable. And finally, you have to take into consideration that the state of the economy and its impact on the motor carrier industry also is another variable. Because as you might imagine, whether or not a motor carrier elects to take the flat fee or chooses instead to report and pay on a mileage basis is going to involve some comparison on his or her part. If I'm going to run an operation that is going to, because business is good and I'm hauling lots of product, I'm going to run a lot of miles, I might opt to take the flat fee approach. If, however, business conditions are oppressed and I'm running comparatively fewer miles, If I run a lot of miles, I might take the flat fee approach. If I'm running few miles, I might opt for the mileage approach, trying to manage my tax liability. It's reasonable. So when you put all three of those factors together, we're getting closer rather than farther apart. The rates were increased last legislative session, and we're in a state of flux in the motor carrier industry, given the economy. The recommendation that the Department of Transportation brings before you is that you not make any change to the current flat fee rates and allow them to trend an additional 2 years and look at it upon the occasion of the next study. That's my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Jim Witte from the ODOT to talk about some things that we are looking to the future on different ways of looking at sort of innovative finance is the way it's put, and he can explain this to you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Witte. I'm manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. Here today, though, I also in the capacity of the staff to the Road User Fee Task Force. The task force was formed in 2001 by legislation and then appointed by the governor, Senate President, and Speaker. The purpose was to create a new road finance system to replace the current one, essentially creating a new use fee to replace the gas tax or the fuel tax, because of projected improvements in vehicle fuel efficiency. In 2003, the Road User Fee Task Force proposed a fee based on vehicle miles traveled to replace the fuel tax. The vehicle miles traveled charge would not shrink with improvements in fuel efficiency like the gas tax does. Then from 2003 to 2006, ODOT developed a collection system for the mileage fee and ran a pilot project in 2006 and 2007 that caught the attention of the nation. The Road User Fee Task Force was reconstituted by the Governor, Senate President, and Speaker in 2010 to address the emerging electric vehicle market. Operators of those vehicles will pay either no gas tax or very little. The situation at hand is serious. There's a rising preference for fuel-efficient vehicles as the price of oil goes up. We saw that in 2008. We're seeing it again in 2010. As well, we see the CAFE standards, the Corporate Average Fuel Efficiency or Economy standards of the federal government, raised to 35 miles per gallon in less than a decade. We already have vehicles on the road that get 50 miles per gallon. regularly. And the Chevy Volt, which is being sold in the United States right now, it's a new car, exceeds 100 miles per gallon and with a range of over 300 miles. And what they're testing in Europe right now is even more interesting, plug-in hybrid diesel vehicles that will get over 200 miles per gallon. They'll sell them, the Volkswagens, in 2013 and test that market. The 2010 task force reviewed the early work of what's known as the RUFTUP, that's the acronym, and the pilot project, and revised the concept for a collection to resolve the issues concerned that emerged over the recent years. There was a privacy issue that emerged with the original concept and the pilot project. It relied on GPS receiver so that the vehicle could locate itself. And the public became concerned with that because there was concern about government tracking. The task force said we should use an electronic means to transfer the odometer reading rather than using GPS. And so I said, let's don't have a GPS mandate. Motorists may be allowed, however, to choose the GPS should they want to electronically differentiate their miles by geographic location. For example, if they drive out of state, or if they're on private property. But that's their option, no government mandate for that. The technology was viewed as stuck in time for the pilot project, and the task force recommended developing an open system technology platform with common standards to allow the technology used to evolve with customer preferences. And then there was perceptions of a large bureaucracy, so the task force recommended allowing the private sector provision of data collection and payment collection services to allow motorists to choose options other than the government for these services. The task force recommends to the legislature that the new system be applied right away to the new electric vehicle market and plug-in hybrids, and has proposed legislation in this session to do so. Madam Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Questions from Jim? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Mr. Witte, as always, for your great and innovative work on this. It seems very clear to me that this is the direction that we're going to have to move to some degree in order to continue to efficiently fund our roads. As you look at third-party collectors to address the privacy issue and the government issue, can you describe a little bit about who those third parties might be? Are we talking like a GM OnStar kind of entity, or what are we talking about?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Bailey, yes, it could be those entities that are now using the navigation units. You see, the government would have to set the standards, technology standards, for what they would want to see the result of. And then the marketplace provides whatever technology to meet those standards. And so navigation units would be one option. Another option might be existing smartphones. So you're seeing, but they would have to be integrated with the, you know, odometer system, and that can be done. We know that. But how it happens, we may have a government option just to have one out there, but we would not say this has to be it. The marketplace would then jump in and provide various other options, and I think the citizens will be more comfortable with that than having a government-mandated thing that they have to use.
It is interesting to me, Representative, that the GPS system as a vehicle mile tax sort of platform was rejected on privacy issues, and yet everyone in their pocket has a little GPS system telling the world exactly where they're going. But that is the reality of public understanding, and I think we need to live with that. But it's fascinating to me. Yes.
I would agree with that, Madam Co-Chair, and add to that that I think in a perfect world, I would feel much more comfortable. Let me say it a different way. I would feel more concerned about what large corporations are going to do with my location data for marketing purposes than I would about what the government is going to do with it. But such are the winds of public opinion.
And there would be others who would disagree with that and have a reverse opinion. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Jim, glad you're here, and it's been a pleasure working with you on the subgroup task force. Could you just address the
thinking that underlies the proposed amount per mile that the electric car would be charged?
Yeah. Madam Chair, we are getting a little bit into, well, no, I can talk about this. The task force did propose an entry rate for the electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electrics that would compare to what the, say, the existing hybrid electrics pay in gas tax, which is roughly 0.6 cents per mile. Now, the average motor vehicle, we've estimated, our economist estimated, this lawyer did not, the economist did, 1.43 cents per mile. That's what the average in gas tax. These would be at the EVs would be pegged at 0.6. The view of the task force, it went around quite a bit. There was a fair amount of debate on this. Was that we should the state should continue the incentive for those vehicles and not disincent the purchase of those vehicles. Task force also thought that at some time, once the market had emerged, that the rate should rise to a natural level that would be helpful. Obviously, if the whole market became electric vehicles, we would have a huge drop in revenue. So at some point after the market matures for electric vehicles, the level would rise.
And the one surprising thing among many on that task force was the current relatively very small number of the all-electric cars that are in Oregon, but the anticipation that this could change dramatically over the period of time before this proposed tax would go into force. And I think it was, is it 2014? Is that the year that we're looking at?
Madam Chair, we're getting into legislation now that is...
As long as in this, we can talk
about it. Madam Chair, Co-Chair Representative Benz, yes, the task force recommended a delay in application, not be immediate, that it would be applied to the 2014 market and begin on January 1st, 2014.
Representative Bentz, I caution Mr. Witte that we do not have a bill open before us, so we cannot be discussing specific legislation without it.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Further questions? And this will be coming back, particularly, I think, to your committee and then to our committee. So we will have further discussion. Anything else while I'm here? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you
very much for coming. And last, we have a report on the congestion pricing pilot in HB 2001, ODOT. We are getting all of our reports done today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committees. My name is Jason Tell, and I'm the Region 1 Manager for ODOT, so I'm based in our Portland office, and I'm here today to give you an update on our work to develop a congestion pricing pilot project in the Portland metropolitan area. This has been a collaborative effort with the City of Portland, Metro, and Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. And my update is going to include a couple parts. I'm going to start with a background about why we're doing this pilot, who's been involved, the process that we've gone through to select the pilot proposals that we're considering, a quick summary of the three current proposals, and then what the next steps are. So first, what is congestion pricing? Congestion pricing is an application of market-based tools to encourage more efficient use of the transportation system. So an example of that is setting variable rate tolls. The point being that at peak times when there's a lot of congestion, the toll rate goes up to encourage people to look at other times of day to travel and to make the system more efficient during that period of time. There's other applications as well, but that's the one that's probably getting the most attention right now. As far as background, the 2009, the Jobs and Transportation Act included Section 3, which created a mandate for ODOT to partner with local jurisdictions to implement one or more congestion pricing pilot projects in the Portland metropolitan area. So after enactment of that law, we formed a congestion pricing advisory committee to solicit, evaluate, and recommend one or more pricing pilot projects. The membership is made up of the jurisdictions I mentioned, which are in the language of the law, and that's the City of Portland, Metro, and the three metropolitan counties. We also formed a technical advisory committee, which has been working over the last year and a half to evaluate all the different candidate proposals that came before the group. So the process that we used was a collaborative one. We solicited proposals from the local partners, and then we screened those different proposals based on some minimum selection criteria. And there's four main criteria that were used. First of all, we wanted to make sure that there was one or more local jurisdictions that were sponsoring the proposal. We wanted to know that there was support, that it wasn't just ODOT proposing something that would have impacts on a local jurisdiction, but that there was support. Second, that local jurisdiction would not just be the immediate one where maybe the location of the proposal was, but if neighboring jurisdictions were impacted, we would also want to see their support. Third, the proposal has to meet the statutory deadline of September 2012 to implement the proposal. And then lastly, we wanted to make sure that the pilot proposal had some reasonable likelihood of success. So additionally, these proposals have to meet some other state and federal requirements. I mentioned the Jobs and Transportation Act. There's federal requirements that are specific to tolling on federal highways. There's also the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, referred to as NEPA, and federal executive orders on environmental justice, just to name a few. So there are a series of state and federal laws that impact the different proposals and whether or not they're viable within the timeline that we have. So as an example, in the Jobs and Transportation Act, it mandates that trucks over 10,000 pounds are exempt from paying any tolls, and it also says that any of the revenue has to be spent consistent with the Oregon Constitution. So that's just a couple examples of some of the constraints. After the committee completed an initial screening process, of all the proposals, they narrowed down on three for further analysis, and the three are Cornelius Pass Road, having a single point time of day toll. The second was on Highway 217, looking at several ramps and tolling those ramps. And then the City of Portland is looking at a parking management proposal. So to look at analyzing these different proposals beyond the minimum requirements, the analysis covered six components. First of all, the degree of public support for the stated policy objectives. One of the things that the committee learned from a lot of research done in Europe and elsewhere is it's really important when you set out to do congestion pricing, a project, you have a very clear policy objective of why you're doing it and that the public has some degree of acceptance of why you're going down that road. Second, that the proposal has an effectiveness at achieving the objective. So it's not enough just to say that we're doing this for a good reason, but you also have to show that it's effective at achieving that policy objective. Third, identifying the affected areas and stakeholders. All of these proposals have different levels of impacts to different people and stakeholders, so identifying those early on. Quantifying direct highway user effects of the different proposals. Overall social benefits and costs, and the degree of public support for proposals. So that's the analytical work that we did for each of these three proposals. And the analysis that was done covered basically, it was in two different categories. One was the traffic modeling, basically, which quantified the traffic impacts, the different proposals, the system effects, and potential revenue. So that was using models that are owned by Metro, working with them. And to get a good sense on public opinion research, we contracted with David Hibbets, and they did public opinion research, statistically valid public opinion research on these proposals. So I will quickly now just at a very high level cover the three specific proposals that are now being considered by the committee. The first is Cornelius Pass Road. Multnomah in Washington County proposed this project on Cornelius Pass Road near US 30, and the policy objective behind this concept was to finance safety improvements. The road is a windy two-lane road between two regional arterial highways, and that was the concept that was being tested with the analysis. When we ran the transportation demand model to kind of figure out what happens when you start doing different toll rates, we found that a $1 one-way toll would reduce traffic on Cornelius Pass by 50%. A $4 toll would result in a six-fold reduction in use. So the point is, on this particular road, in this application, a very small toll results in significant diversion onto other roads, and if you raise the rate, you're going to get a dramatic increase in the amount of diversion. In this case, $2 was found to be sort of the furthest that you could go, and the local system adjacent to that road could handle the diversion. And most of those roads can really only handle about 5,000 cars a day. So one of the results of that was, because of that diversion and the types of roads people would divert to, the nearby roads, Logie Trail Road, Rocky Point Road, are very windy roads, very rural roads, not really meant to handle large volumes of traffic. So one of the issues that came up was concern that you may be moving a safety problem from Cornelius Pass Road to the parallel routes. At $2, as I said, that was sort of the optimum in terms of generating revenue, but not diverting all of the traffic off to parallel routes. And we looked at the revenue side of that and what it costs to collect the toll. Basically, it takes about 5 years to pay off the capital equipment you have to put in place to collect the toll. And over the 25-year life of the pilot, you generate about $5 to $6 million. So you do generate some money if this proposal were to move forward, but it's about $5 to $6 million over 25 years, and then there's this issue of diversion that comes into play. The other analysis that was done, as I mentioned, was public opinion research, and that found that 57% of residents in the area already considered Cornelius Pass Road to be safe, which that was new information to us. There were some assumptions, I think, by the counties when they put forward the proposal that there was more perceived issues there with the road. Secondly, over 65% of those polled opposed paying a toll, even if it was only $1. The second, and I'm giving you the very, very high level. There's much more information that we can get you when we get to questions and answers follow-up, but I'm going to give you kind of the very high level. Second proposal that was analyzed is on Highway 217, and that is basically looking at three ramps, Wilshire, Walker, and Denny. And the policy objective behind tolling those three ramps is to try to improve the flow on 217 and reduce the number of accidents. One of the major problems with 217, there's so many closely spaced ramps that it operationally makes it not function well, but it also means that you have a high number of crashes, which further makes the operations of the road not work very well. So the policy objective here is to look at, can you make it flow better by reducing traffic at some of the ramps? And then with the revenue generated from those tolls at the ramps, the concept is to put that money into improvements in the road. So the initial analysis that was done shows that tolls at those ramps will reduce the volumes at the ramp. So at a $2 toll at those ramps, you reduce volumes by 90%. It also would reduce mainline traffic volumes on the highway by 10%. So what happens basically is you set a toll at those ramps, people will either stay on the local system and avoid 217, or perhaps they'll find another ramp. And when we looked at the revenue side, with a $2 toll, it was projected after you pay off the expenses of setting up the system to collect the tolls, you generate about $2.8 million over the 25-year period. And that is a combination of you have a lot of diversion, so people are avoiding paying the toll, and secondly, that you have a higher use. The way the fees are basically paid to collect these tolls is by the number of vehicles. So this one has a higher number than the Cornelius Pass example. So one of the things that we decided we need to look at further because of that diversion was what's the impact on local streets. And with our partners at the table, they also were very interested to know what the impact would be on the local system. And so we're doing some more analysis to find out what that impact is, what happens at intersections on local streets, for example. When we looked at the public opinion research, it showed a 39% in support of a 50-cent toll, 36% in support of a $2 toll. The third project that is being considered is proposed by the City of Portland, and it's looking at a series of parking pricing management strategies. And they are right now still going through some public outreach to decide which specific proposal they're looking at. But the idea is an area that are very congested, and you have a mix of commercial and other uses, particularly where it's in your neighborhoods. Can you price parking differently to basically get the most efficient use of that and balance the needs of the neighborhoods as well as the commercial interests? So we don't have the same level of analysis on that proposal as we do for the two road proposals, because the city's still kind of developing exactly what they want to analyze. But we expect to have more results later this spring on that, so we'll be able to follow up with more information on that. So right now, the staff and the consultant team are finishing the last pieces of technical analysis on the two road projects, for example, on 217, identifying what the local improvements might need to be to handle diversion. And that analysis is going to be done soon. Our next meeting of our advisory committee is on April 4th, and at that meeting I expect we'll have all of this information, and that's really when the committee needs to make a recommendation on what we're going to move forward with, because we need to get into implementation phase here very shortly to meet the deadlines of the Act. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Tell. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Tell, I'm just trying to make sure I understand correctly the process here. You've completed the analysis with the modeling on potential projects, and now the next step is to move to actually implement the projects on in these areas. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Bailey, yes, the analysis has been done on the three proposals I mentioned. Those three were the three that got through the minimum criteria that were set. So there were other options looked at, but we narrowed to the three. All that information goes back to the Policy Advisory Committee for an April 4th meeting. At that point, what I'm going to put in front of the committee is for them to make a decision which one or more of these is going to go forward in implementation. That's a question that will be put on the table at the meeting.
Well, Madam Butcher. And by my count, we're about halfway to the deadline. Are we going to make it?
Well, it depends on, I think, what we decide to go with here and what we find out from the folks that are going to have to help us implement it. Because it's a pilot program, the three proposals that you see are were in part narrowed down to those because we think that they have the highest likelihood of getting done. You know, these are smaller scale proposals. These are not, you know, big major proposals that would, for instance, trigger NEPA. So it depends on which one we go with. It depends if we go with more than one. So we'll see where we are in April. I'm happy to report back what we decide. I think if we make a decision in April, based on the feedback we got from the consultants looking at what it would take to put them in a place, they thought it would be feasible to get it done.
Comment, Madam Kutcher?
Yes.
If it's possible, whether it's offline or in front of a committee, I would very much like to hear back in April about mm-hmm. how that decision-making process went, and I think other members of the committee would like to know as well. Thank you.
Okay, be happy to.
Let me do that. Further questions or comments? Yes, Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm finding myself a little puzzled about the ramp tolls on Highway 217. I am not as familiar with that road as I might be if I lived in the area. I do know that there are a bunch of on-ramps that are very closely spaced. I wonder if anybody thought about the possibility of simply closing some of them during peak hours rather than going through all the infrastructure expenses for what appears to be a pretty small return over a long period of time.
It's a great question, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Barnhart, and we actually just completed the first phase of a study that came before we did this analysis as a congestion pricing pilot. And in that study, what we looked at is exactly what you said. What if we were to simply close ramps on 217 with the purpose of reducing the number of accidents and creating a better operational, you know, throughput on the highway? We did that study with both the cities that would be impacted, the county, metro, and some others. Representative Greenlick was on our group as we did that. And a lot of that information was fed into this study looking at pricing. And you get, like you said, you do get the result by closing ramps. People will find another way to travel. The major concern raised in that study was, so where does that traffic go and what are you going to do to the local system? Are we just moving a problem? So that group is doing a little more analysis, like I said, similar to what we're doing on the congestion pricing, to try to quantify, you know, how much money would it take to improve the local system so that if we were to shift traffic, we're just not moving a problem somewhere else. So your question's a good one, and we've got some information around that. When you start to look at closing ramps, depending on which ones you look at, you know, get near Washington Square, and we hear very loudly from businesses and from the mayor, you shouldn't do it. The impact's too great. And so in part on the congestion pricing pilot, the reason why we only looked at the three that we did was based on input from local elected officials telling us that, you know, you really have to be selective on where you go. We don't want to look at impacting ramps that might have a major impact to business.
Just follow up. I think this is more of a comment than a question. I think what this discussion illustrates is the huge difficulty when you are trying to deal with a system that is significantly overutilized, and none of the choices that the smart people come up with even are ones that you would prefer. You'd like something else that you can't find.
Yeah, and Madam Co-Chair Barnhart, one of the challenges of doing a pilot, I mean, the express purpose of a pilot is you do something quickly, you do it kind of a smaller scale. When you take that approach, the transportation system functions as a system. So whether it's Cornelius Pass or three ramps on 217, when you start to look at doing that, there are impacts to the rest of the system that then you have to figure out how to deal with. In addition to the work we're doing, Metro soon, as part of the greenhouse gas efforts, will be modeling and looking at scenarios. What if you priced the entire system or some more broader system approach? And that has its own set of challenges to do that, but it does get at the system issue of if you go at this problem and just try to tackle a particular three ramps, let's say, or one particular road when you have a lot of parallel routes, if you don't have a system in place to capture that or deal with that, you know, we have to address it somehow. So that's the challenge of doing a pilot versus looking at something larger. Doing a larger system approach means you capture those issues, but also means the impact is greater. It's a much more radical change in the way we do things today, and so you've got to get greater public acceptance, you know, around doing something on a larger scale. So these each have their challenges. Hmm. I should just say, I have to tell you that there's been a lot of talk about congestion pricing theoretically and planning documents. In the Portland region, it's been sort of listed as something we should look at for a long time, and I am happy to report this group has really rolled up their sleeves and spent a lot of time, and this stuff can get pretty complicated, to really better understand it so that when we're ready to go do something, you know, we're going to have the highest possible chance of success. I mean, that's what we want. And what we're finding is that there are certain applications where this may make sense and others it doesn't. And so we want to do the hard work to provide the decision makers with some good information and the public with good information so that when we do implement something, that it's something that will be seen as a positive. That's our goal.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Till? Appreciate you coming.
You bet.
Appreciate this report, and it's a good update for all of us.
Yeah.
And this is heavy lifting, what you're doing.
Thanks.
That concludes our testimony. Is there anyone else who has a burning desire to come up and discuss transportation issues without?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would simply note that tomorrow, during the normal time for the Revenue Committee, we have two committees meeting, one at 8, one at 9, challenging issues in the first meeting. I know I'm speaking to the wrong group, but I hope everyone shows up on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, we are adjourned for this morning.